Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading The Hill from Monday, August 17. The story, Navy considers major aircraft carrier revamp to better suit Trump's aesthetic. The U.S. Navy is weighing a major revamp of the design of its new class of aircraft carriers to better suit the desires expressed by President Trump as the White House continues to wade into the designs of naval warships. The Navy is performing an internal review where it is weighing the possibility of moving the multi-story aircraft carrier's command center tower, known as the Island, more toward the middle of the vessel to better match the aesthetic of older warships, a former senior U.S. official familiar with the matter, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss internal deliberations, told The Hill on Sunday. The review, which was kickstarted in part due to Trump's concerns about the aesthetics of the Ford-class aircraft carriers, is due in several weeks, the official also said. The Hill has reached out to the Pentagon and Navy for comment. The Island, which stands above the rest of the aircraft carrier and is most often located on the starboard side, is the nerve center to manage flight deck operations, tactical command, and the vessel's navigation. Hunter Stiers, who served as the maritime strategist to the Navy Secretary until last year, said warships are built to win in combat, not to win a beauty pageant. The placement of the Island on the Ford class was chosen to support the ship's design purpose of maximizing aircraft sortie generation, which for an aircraft carrier directly translates to combat power. A good faith exploration of future carrier design based on real-world operational requirements is one thing, Stiers told The Hill on Sunday. Expanding millions of taxpayer dollars and the time and energy of the Navy's engineering organizations, redesigning the nation's premier capital ship to indulge the president's aesthetic whims is not only wasteful and abusive, it exemplifies President Trump's evident contempt for America's fighting sailors, Stiers said. Navy Captain Paul Pauly Lanzalotta, then captain of the USS Gerald R. Ford, the world's largest aircraft carrier, said 4 years ago that the extra room in front of the Island on the ship allows aircraft on the deck more space to line up before taking off. If you're a little bit late, you need to troubleshoot. Maybe it's just reset a system that's built into the aircraft. You reset the system and off you go. You can taxi to the catapult, Lanzalotta told the War Zone in 2022. If you're parked after the Island on older ships, you need a break in the recovery in order to do that, because everything we do happens very, very quickly, very efficiently. The review to potentially move the Island on Ford-class aircraft carriers more toward the front would be the second significant design change influenced by the Commander-in-Chief. On Thursday, Trump directed the Navy to remove the electromagnetic catapult system on aircraft carriers to launch fighter planes and revert back to using steam catapult systems, an adjustment that officials and experts say would cost billions of dollars and would hamper operational efficiency. The president, in a national security memo, ordered the service branch to ensure Ford-class aircraft carriers such as the USS Doris Miller, which is currently being built, are equipped with steam-powered catapult and hydraulic systems as opposed to newer electromagnetic aircraft launch systems, or EMALS, and advanced weapons elevators. The internal Navy review was first reported by the Washington Post on Saturday. Apart from USS Doris Miller, there are two other Ford-class aircraft carriers under construction. The Navy has 11 Nimitz-class aircraft carriers. The USS Enterprise, a third Ford-class nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, is under construction by Huntington Ingalls Industries at Newport News Shipbuilding. The construction of the Ford-class carriers is expected to cost around $22 billion for each ship, an August estimate from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office said. The story, more, Trump's response to reported USS Abraham Lincoln conditions pisses me off. Maryland Governor Wes Moore, Democrat, on Sunday expressed anger over President Trump's reaction to reported conditions on the USS Abraham Lincoln. I mean, not only are these conditions and the reports of the conditions heartbreaking, the response of the President of the United States pisses me off, and it should piss all of us off, Moore, an Army veteran, told CNN's Jake Tapper on State of the Union. But you know what? I would have hoped that, since he's never been forward deployed, since he's never put on the uniform and sacrificed for this country, that he would have more compassion for the people who are willing to, that he would have more compassion for their family members who are willing to offer their loved ones to the country because they love this country so much, the Maryland governor added. On Friday, Trump disagreed with the idea that family members of sailors and troops on the USS Abraham Lincoln were worried over the state of the aircraft carrier. No, they're not, Trump told reporters when questioned about reports that highlighted the deteriorating conditions. That ship is moving right now, or for very shortly, and is being replaced with another very similar ship, Trump added, confirming that the U.S. was moving another aircraft carrier, the USS George Washington, to the Middle East to replace the USS Lincoln. In November, the Lincoln deployed from San Diego and has remained out at sea uninterrupted for more than 260 days. Prompted by the reports from the media outlets of declining conditions aboard the aircraft carrier, Democratic lawmakers have pressed Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and the Trump administration for more information about the service members' mental health and living conditions. The Hill has reached out to the White House for comment. The story, CENTCOM commander addresses mental health concerns for troops on USS Abraham Lincoln. U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, Commander Admiral Brad Cooper on Sunday addressed concerns about the mental health of service members aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln as the aircraft carrier returns home after being docked in the Middle East for more than 260 days. Cooper called his visit to the ship on Saturday awe-inspiring, in a statement saying Americans would beam with pride over the work carried out while on board. Here's an important fact. Of the Navy's 11 aircraft active aircraft carriers, the Lincoln currently has among the lowest number of cases related to mental health. This doesn't mean that all is perfect. Find any of the nearly 4 million Navy veterans in America today, and they will likely tell you that service at sea for long periods isn't for everyone. Cooper called it challenging and tough for all service members, and that even he reacts to stressors in different ways. I've long believed that mental health is another aspect of individual health and requires our attention, just like physical health and spiritual health, he continued. I applaud Lincoln's leadership, the senior enlisted leaders, and the chief petty officer's mess, in particular, for stepping up and making mental health and crew resilience a leadership priority. Cooper visited the ship as part of a 10-day trip where he visited Bahrain, Iraq, Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Recent reports from news outlets about the Lincoln garnered attention as they described poor conditions, including moldy showers and rotten food, with some sailors even attempting to jump off the aircraft carrier. These reports prompted congressional Democrats to launch inquiries into the mental and physical states of crew members, along with the federal government's response. Acting Navy Secretary Hung Cao on Friday announced that the ship was returning home. The Lincoln's deployment was initially intended to end in May before it was extended to its current tenure. After Cao said the mission demanded it, the ship departed San Diego in November. Details will come, but let me be clear. The safety and security of our sailors and Marines always comes first, Cao said in a statement. Mission accomplishment, troop warfare, welfare, that is how we lead. The U.S. military, which has said the reports have been overblown or mischaracterized, is sending the USS George Washington to the Middle East in place of the Lincoln. Cao has accused media outlets of trying to paint our warriors as victims. Not only is that dishonest, but it takes away the focus on the enemy and the threat it poses against our nation, people, and way of life, he said in the same statement. The story, Ossoff, something uniquely despicable about lying a nation into war. Senator John Ossoff, Democrat of Georgia, on Sunday took a swing at President Trump over the Iran war, saying he lied the nation into a war. During a Sunday rally in Atlanta, the Georgia Democrat went after Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth for their management of the war against Iran. Ossoff said that Trump promised to lower prices on day one and promised peace and gave us war. Remember last year, they claimed Iran's nuclear program had been obliterated. Then this year, they claimed it posed an immediate nuclear threat. Both times, lies. On day one of the war, listen to this, day one, the president said the war was, quote, ahead of schedule, ahead of schedule. On day four, he declared victory. Today is day 170, said Ossoff, who is running for re-election this year. The senator then turned his criticism to Hegseth. Listen to this. On day nine of the war, the incompetent Pete Hegseth guaranteed Iranian surrender. On day 14, he claimed Iran's military had been destroyed. On day 40, he said every single objective had been achieved. That was 4 months ago, Ossoff added. The Georgia Democrat later stated that there's something uniquely despicable about lying a nation into war, treating citizens as fools, and those who serve as pawns. The Iran war is about to hit the six-month mark and has proven unpopular among the American public as Trump and the Republicans head into this year's midterms. Ossoff is aiming to keep his seat in the upper chamber, with both sides of the aisle having tight margins in both chambers. The war has also raised gas prices as the Strait of Hormuz, a key waterway for the oil industry, has been closed. According to AAA, the average price of a gallon of regular gas in the U.S. sat at about $4.07 on Sunday night, with the price at the same time last year for the same gallon at about $3.14. In Georgia, the average price of a regular gallon of gas on Sunday night was about $3.80, up from about $2.91 last year. The Hill has reached out to the White House for comment. The story, questions about Schumer's future, grow as Democratic candidates call for change. Questions are growing about Senator Chuck Schumer's Democrat of New York future as an increasing number of Democratic candidates say they will not support his bid for another term as Senate Democratic leader. Progressive critics of the Democratic establishment are calling for a leadership shakeup in Washington as their candidates win Senate Democratic primaries in Illinois, Maine, Michigan, and Minnesota. These candidates have the backing of progressive Democratic senators in Schumer's caucus. They say the party has become too aligned with corporate interests and is not fighting hard enough to increase taxes on the wealthy and expand the social safety net. Progressive candidates Abdul El Sayed in Michigan, Peggy Flanagan in Minnesota, and Troy Jackson in Maine, who all won competitive primaries, say they will not vote for Schumer as leader. Illinois Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, who won the Democratic primary to succeed retiring Democratic Whip Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, said in March she won't vote for Schumer to serve another term because voters all across the state of Illinois are fed up with what's happening in Washington. Even so, Senate Democratic insiders say Schumer, who is 75, is likely to remain as Democratic leader. Schumer is hailed by these voices as a tireless worker and prodigious fundraiser for his party and colleagues. Schumer's allies note that he scored impressive recruiting wins in North Carolina, Ohio, Iowa, and Alaska. Schumer played a key role in convincing candidates, such as former North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, Democrat, former three-term Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat, Iowa State Representative Josh Turek, Democrat, and former Alaska Representative Mary Peltola, Democrat, to run for the Senate. A Democratic senator who requested anonymity to talk about Schumer's future said there doesn't appear to be a challenger in this caucus gearing up. The lawmaker warned that could change if Senate Democrats underperform in the November elections. The lawmaker argued that the victories of progressives in Senate primaries shows that voters are hungry for political leaders who will take on entrenched corporate interests. It sends a really powerful message that Americans are increasingly fed up with oligarchs, dark money, corporations having all the power, and folks who are campaigning saying that they will take on the establishment have enormous appeal, the senator said. Any party that doesn't listen to that, on both sides of the aisle, is probably screwing up. There's a sense from a lot of people, probably on both sides of the aisle, that the folks here in the Senate, in the end, do work for the powerful, the senator said, noting that special interest groups spent $60 million to defeat El Sayed in his race against Representative Haley Stevens, Democrat of Michigan. People realize they can take on these powerful issues and make it an issue that they're spending these vast sums, the senator said. One of Schumer's strongest attributes as a leader has been his ability to raise huge sums of money for candidates and the party, but now his connections to deep pockets could become a target for progressive critics to use against him. The senator said Schumer's future would depend heavily on how progressive critics such as El Sayed fare in the general election and whether Democrats pick up a good number of seats when they have the political wind at their backs because of President Trump's low approval numbers. A strategist allied with Schumer and other Democratic leaders, however, push back on the narrative that the progressive left is gaining more influence and will push the party further to the left. Clearly, Abdul is very talented, and we'll see where all this ends, said the strategist, who cautioned that progressives need to show they can win outside of heavily Democratic blue states. Democratic Socialist candidate Francesca Hong notably lost in a Wisconsin Democratic primary for governor last week. Is the party really moving left? Is it really? That's the mainstream media narrative, but is it? The strategist said. Does the data really yield that we are really moving left, or that part is the majority of the party? Senate insiders see Senator Brian Schatz, Democrat of Hawaii, who has locked up the votes to become Senate Democratic whip, as a candidate to succeed Schumer one day. Whip is the number two position in leadership. But there is growing buzz about Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada, a more centrist Democrat who has a talented staff working for her and an impressive fundraising network to draw on if she ever ascends to the top spot. Democratic strategists are split on how much opposition Schumer faces within his own party. Steve Jarding, a Democratic strategist and former senior aide to the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, said Schumer's future in leadership depends on picking up a good number of Senate seats this fall. It's still a numbers game at the end of the day, and if the Democrats don't do well, and it's at least 50-50 in the Senate next year, I just think in this cycle with all the energy, if we take the House and what we fall short in the Senate, somebody is going to have it to pay a price, and obviously the most likely person is Chuck Schumer, he said. Jarding said Schumer has become the status quo establishment leader. I think that train has left the station a long time ago. It's not where the American public is, he said. Democrats have a 41% approval, and Republicans have a 39% approval. If the Democrats take back the Senate, at least he's got a case to say, I was the leader when we took back the Senate, he added. Jarding warned that if Senate Democratic candidates perform worse than expected in November, Schumer could face trouble. But Jim Kessler, a former Schumer aide, said Schumer's job is safe and that the Democrats who say they won't support him serving another term as leader are a small fraction of the caucus. If Democrats can take the Senate, Chuck Schumer is the leader, period, the end, he said. Even though there are going to be some new members, part of their primary campaign was running against Schumer as leader, and that was a tiny part of the caucus. Leaders don't get replaced because they won, he said. If Democrats are going to retake the Senate, it means the folks Schumer nurtured to get into the race won. Kessler, the executive vice president for policy at Third Way, a centrist Democratic think tank, pointed out that Schumer just needs to win a majority of his own caucus, unlike someone running for a speaker in the House who needs a majority of the entire chamber and a floor vote. Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland is another rising Senate Democratic star in the mix of names being discussed to someday become Senate Democratic leader. Van Hollen is naturally allied with Senate progressives who want the next Democratic leader to push a more ambitious agenda and do more to take on corporate and special interests. Van Hollen, in an interview with CNN last month, declined to say whether he would support Schumer remaining as Democratic leader beyond 2026, saying he is focused on the 2026 elections. Van Hollen is interested, and the progressives like him more, said a source familiar with jockeying among Democratic senators for possible future leadership bids. Senator Elizabeth Slotkin, Democrat of Michigan, in June called for new leadership within the Democratic Party, arguing that the party hasn't fully recovered from its 2024 election losses. "Every day there's a debate within the party about the path forward," she told SiriusXM's Straight Shooter podcast with Stephen A. Smith. Senators Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, and Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, who want the Democratic Party to adopt a bolder agenda and challenge corporate interests more aggressively, have flexed their muscle by endorsing winning progressive candidates in competitive primaries. They won't yet talk about what big progressive wins should mean for the future of the Senate Democratic leadership or Schumer's future, but they are preparing to claim a mandate if the election goes as they hope. Sanders hailed El-Sayed's victory in the Michigan Senate Democratic primary as a watershed moment, calling it the biggest upset in his life. He said El-Sayed had to take on the Michigan Democratic establishment, the National Democratic establishment, and the $60 million in super PAC spending deployed against him. But Sanders declined to talk about El-Sayed's desire to replace Schumer with Van Hollen. "That's not, I think, the major issue of today," he said. Warren says she's focused on the November election, not a future battle over the Senate Democratic leadership. "My goal is to get people who will fight for America's working families here in the Senate, and every vote counts," she said, declining to discuss her own leadership ambitions within the caucus. "I want to do everything I can to help working families. We need a Democratic Party that's willing to do that." Warren, who is 77, is not viewed as a likely leadership candidate, but she will wield more influence in the conference if El-Sayed and other progressives, such as Jackson in Maine and Flanagan in Minnesota, win on November 3. The story: Ocasio-Cortez gets personal as Democrats make case for relatability. Since announcing that she was freezing her eggs on Instagram last weekend, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democrat of New York, has spent the week taking her 9.6 million followers along for the ride, chronicling the process in detailed videos and answering questions while administering her shots. On Thursday, she said as she was recording one of those shots, she ran out of storage on her iPhone. "And I have an iCloud account, and it is a big one, and it is supposed to upload, and it's just not," the congresswoman said while resting on her couch. "I need IT support." A couple of hours later, Ocasio-Cortez posted another video of herself at the mall, writing that she was addressing the issue alongside three laugh cry emojis. The video sought to provide an intimate look at Ocasio-Cortez's everyday life, from the personal to the mundane, to her large number of followers in a week where she stirred speculation about her political future. And in the run-up to the 2028 presidential election, she's hardly the only Democratic White House hopeful, giving a look, however manufactured, to their fans. Increasingly, prospective candidates are trying to let voters in on parts of their lives that politicians once kept behind lock and key. It's all about the desire from voters for authenticity in political candidates. Politicians are sharing their personal stories and decisions along with their dinner table conversations. They're inviting voters not just to their living rooms, but to their gyms, as was the case with Ocasio-Cortez earlier this week, and their favorite restaurants to sit beside them as they make their case for relatability and authenticity. There's always been a notion that in politics, the candidate you most want to have a beer with is the one you'll vote for. Now candidates are using social media to make that personal case. two high-profile Democrats literally invited people to have a virtual beer with them on California Governor Gavin Newsom's podcast Thursday. He and Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer sat together at Crunchy's, a dive bar in East Lansing, Michigan, playfully teasing each other about their political ambitions over a brew. At one point, Newsom tried to prod Whitmer into saying she's going to run for higher office. When Whitmer shook her head and smiled, Newsom retorted, "The pause says it all." The banter continued for a few minutes, with Newsom trying to get an answer and Whitmer dodging him. "Shut up," she said, in the tone of an annoyed sibling. "You are a pain." Strategists say the 2028 White House race will inevitably begin the day after the midterms, and would-be candidates aren't wasting their time trying to lure voters by showing their relatability. "Time is of the essence," said Democratic strategist Brad Bannon. He predicted that other presidential hopefuls would make fervent personal pitches in the coming weeks, as Ocasio-Cortez did. Democratic strategist Basil Smickle added that social media has erased the traditional boundaries between voters and their elected representatives. It also means voters don't put them on pedestals as before. "They're not better than us. They're one of us," Smickle said. The older standard was, "Can I have a beer with them?" Now it's, "Do they face the same choices that I do?" Earlier this month, Pete Buttigieg, the former Transportation Department secretary, posted a video of himself being interviewed by an 11-year-old girl named Hannah, who is a self-proclaimed mountain biker and Star Wars aficionado. Asked whether he had learned a life lesson from Star Wars, Buttigieg, as the movie's theme played in the background, pointed to the movie's character Darth Vader. "You never quite know how something is going to end or how somebody is going to turn out," he said. Buttigieg then turned the questions on Hannah, asking about the best part of being 11 and whether she had any advice for him on the road. "I'm not really the person you should be asking advice from. Oh dear," she replied as Buttigieg laughed. Other prospective candidates have found their own ways to be relatable. Earlier this week, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, Democrat, posted a video of his dog Winnie bounding through and disappearing into a sea of purple flowers set to the Baby Shark children's song. The governor called the post Winnie Shark. On the 4th of July, Winnie made another appearance, this time donned in earmuffs. "Winnie is reminding everyone to protect your pets from the fireworks this weekend," the post read. Maryland Governor Wes Moore, Democrat who is up for re-election in November, recently launched a series called Pull Up a Chair, featuring conversations with people across his state. In the most recent episode, he sat down at a checkered tablecloth across from the owner of a Baltimore pizzeria to talk about the restaurateur's success story. "I like doers," Moore told him. In Ocasio-Cortez's case, she was back to posting videos of her egg freezing on Thursday night, a sign her phone's storage was up and running again. It was day 6 of her egg freezing journey, and she told her followers she found the online response she was getting incredibly overwhelming, underscoring the point that she had succeeded in having her followers relate to her personal news. "I can see, you know, completely independent of what I'm sharing, help with each other and say, I went through this too," she said. "And people are asking each other questions and realizing you are not alone." The story: Cruz, Cantwell seek to get their college sports bill over the goal line, a landmark piece of legislation seeking to regulate the big business of college sports, is expected to face a crucial vote in the Senate when lawmakers return from recess next month. The Protect College Sports Act, championed by Senators Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, and Maria Cantwell, Democrat of Washington, gained steam this summer thanks to the support of President Trump, the NCAA, and a number of current and former college coaches. Backers of the bill argue the system governing major college athletics is broken and benefits a smaller number of large universities that can't afford to lure top athletes away from smaller schools with the promise of name, image, and likeness, or NIL, money. The only way to fix these issues, the NCAA and its allies say, is through intervention by Congress. It's unclear whether the Cruz Cantwell effort will be successful. A key sticking point is the sweeping antitrust protection it would grant the NCAA. The protection would shield the NCAA from litigation around key issues like the transfer portal, revenue sharing, and caps on NIL that can be paid to student-athletes. Critics of the bill and others like it that have been proposed on Capitol Hill contend it would hand the NCAA and top conferences too much power over smaller schools and limit student-athlete earning potential. Some lawmakers, meanwhile, have raised concern with the bill's provisions regarding funding for women's and Olympic sports, which at many schools are heavily subsidized by big-money football and basketball programs. The legislation appeared headed for the Senate floor after Cruz and Cantwell in August won the support of the NCAA's top two conferences, the Southeastern Conference and the Big Ten, which had held out on the bill for months. But a vote at the end of the Senate's work period in August on the proposal was tabled after a group of GOP lawmakers led by Senator Josh Hawley, Republican of Missouri, said they would not vote for it out of concern the bill would override the state laws banning transgender athletes in women's sports. Some are claiming this bill overrides state laws protecting women's sports. It does not. I drafted this legislation to preserve those laws, not weaken them. It leaves Title IX untouched and does nothing to disturb the 27 state laws protecting women's sports, Cruz wrote in a statement pushing back on Hawley. While critics debate a legal theory the text does not support, schools are eliminating women's and Olympic sports, and college athletics is descending further into chaos. We may not get another chance to save the college sports we love. Congress on multiple occasions has tried and failed to pass legislation regulating college sports. The SCORE Act, a House bill that would have granted the NCAA similar protections, died in the lower chamber last year after the Congressional Black Caucus said its members would not support the proposal over GOP redistricting efforts in southern states that are home to the Southeastern Conference schools. The NAACP similarly came out against the Senate bill this month. NAACP President Derek Johnson called it unacceptable that black taxpayers are subsidizing the states, institutions, and athletic systems that work to diminish their political power. This has led to doubts that the Cruz-Cantwell bill can win enough Democratic votes to pass. I think college sports needs reform, but the new Senate college sports bill is not the way to fix it, said Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat of Connecticut, one of the bill's most vocal holdouts. It creates two different systems, one for athletes that limits and micromanages their compensation, and another with no limits for coaches, ADs, and sports industry execs. Not all Democrats are against Cruz and Cantwell's proposal, however. Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, told The Hill he was personally lobbied by Pete Bevacqua, the athletic director at the University of Notre Dame and a member of President Trump's College Sports Task Force, to whip support for the legislation within his party. I'm literally texting a colleague right now about it and have been thrilled to play no small part in catalyzing this, Coons said, expressing frustration that Hawley's group injected a debate about transgender athletes into Senate's college sports regulatory push. It's a ludicrous distraction, Coons said. Senator Cruz has told them this bill does not preempt state law. It's just disappointing on an issue where for Republicans and Democrats there's an urgent need for us to show we can act, that they're throwing a spike on the one-yard line to trip us up. Trump has also reportedly been heavily involved in trying to convince hesitant GOP senators to vote for the bill, calling lawmakers directly and urging them to support the proposal. While Trump's effort could flip the necessary Republican skeptics to back the Save College Sports Act, some observers warn it could turn off Democrats who are not eager to hand the president a bipartisan legislative victory before the midterm elections. In fact, the bill was tabled before the August recess, shows how complicated the proposal is. These people say, and underscores that time, is not on the Protect College Sports Act's side. If you had asked me 3 weeks ago, my view would have been very different. It seems like it had little to no chance, but the fact that they got this SEC and Big Ten is a critical difference maker, said Jib Johnston, an attorney specializing in sports business law, who has been closely following the NCAA's efforts on Capitol Hill. But if it's going to happen, it needs to be in September, because the closer we get to November, people are going to start thinking about what the math looks like in a new Congress. Extra points. It was a whirlwind week for the WNBA, which continues to find itself at the center of cultural debate around issues concerning gender, race, and equity. Indiana Fever coach Stephanie White, whose team is the focus of much of the back and forth, echoed a sentiment telegraphed from the league's top brass, expressing frustration to the media that the WNBA is being hijacked by what she called divisiveness and hate. The league has largely remained silent on a pair of former men's pro basketball players who say they intend to seek eligibility for the WNBA draft, which is typically held in the spring. The Los Angeles Lakers, arguably one of the biggest brands in professional sports, were sold this week by billionaire Mark Walter to former Disney head Bob Iger and Josh Kushner, the brother of Jared Kushner. Critics of the involvement of Josh Kushner have pointed out that Walter, who is making an estimated $2 billion on the deal after buying the Lakers just more than a year ago, is facing scrutiny from the federal government over alleged financial irregularities at his various companies. LIV Golf officially canceled its end-of-season team championships this summer. The move is fueling further speculation. The Alternative Professional Golf League could soon fold after Saudi Arabia pulled funding from the venture. A number of the tour's top stars, like Bryson DeChambeau and John Rahm, have yet to commit to it. Jocks on the Hill, Representative Michael Cloud, Republican of Texas, who attended Oral Roberts University and has been a member of the House since 2018, answered some sports questions for The Hill. Favorite sport? I ran track because that's what I was good at, but I probably enjoyed playing basketball more and watching football. Favorite team? Texas teams in general. I'm in South Texas, so it's the Texans versus Cowboys thing, and the Texans have been so much fun to watch lately, and meanwhile, the Cowboys have the there's always next year thing going. Is there an athlete you admired growing up? Oh yeah, there were a number. The first Super Bowl I remember was the Bears and Patriots and Walter Payton. That was a classic. Hate is a strong word, but is there a team you love to root against? Yes, not a big Lakers fan, I guess, especially since Magic Johnson left. Sports and politics are full of cliches. Is the one that resonates with you? Being a long-distance runner, sometimes it feels like a long-distance race, getting stuff done up here. I wish it wasn't, but laughs. Read the coverage. The Athletic has a pretty incredible read on Michael Blatt, a former NFL super agent who was passed over for a job running the Seattle Seahawks and is the focus of a murder mystery that has still not been solved. Some observers have suggested all the controversy surrounding the WNBA ultimately could be a good thing for the league, which has exploded in popularity with the emergence of superstars like Caitlin Clark. Sports Illustrated's Jimmy Traina writes that fans are tuning into WNBA games more than they did last year, which he argues is what matters most. The Ringer's Danny Chow has a pointed piece on the Lakers' sale to Iger and Josh Kushner, which he writes signals a bleak new era of NBA ownership. The story, Jeffries, I don't support DSA agenda. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat of New York, said Sunday that he does not back the agenda of the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, even as Democratic Socialists and left-leaning candidates racked up primary wins in the last few months. I don't support the DSA agenda, as has been articulated by the DSA itself. Now you're going to have individual members who have been elected in Democratic primaries, and if they are elected in the general in November, will be part of the House Democratic Caucus. It's going to be a broad caucus. There will be progressives. There will be new Dems. There will be blue dogs, Jeffries told host Kristen Welker during the congressman's appearance on Meet the Press Sunday, noting other factions of the Democratic Party. What I'm excited about are the candidates who are running to flip seats in November to deliver us a majority that pushes back against Donald Trump's extremism and moves the country in the right direction, he continued. Democratic socialists and insurgent progressive candidates have beat out more establishment figures in recent Democratic primaries. The DSA, a nonprofit activist group, is the central organizational machine behind democratic socialism in the U.S., but some candidates may back democratic socialist ideology without being formal members of the organization. On its website, the DSA describes democratic socialism as a system where ordinary people have a real voice in our workplaces, neighborhoods, and society, and outlines a push for collective ownership of key economic drivers that dominate our lives. Democrats are facing favorable political territory as they head into this year's midterms. Republicans and President Trump are on the back foot with issues like the Iran war and the current state of the economy driving their unpopularity, according to recent polling. The story, Buttigieg endorses Poindexter in House race against Miller. Former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is endorsing Brook Park City Council member and iron worker Brian Poindexter as he challenges controversy-ridden Representative Max Miller, Republican of Ohio, in November. He's an example of somebody who walks the walk. He knows what working families are going through because he's literally a card-carrying union iron worker. Buttigieg, who's widely seen as a 2028 hopeful, told The Hill in an exclusive interview ahead of the announcement. He's raised in a working-class family, and so he's in this for the right reasons and has the right priorities. Poindexter is running against Miller, a two-term incumbent who represents a swath of Ohio situated south of Cleveland and west of Akron in a seat that in any other cycle would be seen as likely Republican. President Trump won Ohio's 7th congressional district in 2024 by 11 points, but Miller is facing serious domestic abuse allegations from his ex-wife, including that he held a gun to her head, severely burned her with hot water from a skillet, and fractured their daughter's collarbone, allegations Miller has vehemently denied. Miller and his wife are both vying for custody over their daughter. He's also made clear that he will not exit the race, even as both of Ohio's GOP senators, including his father-in-law, Senator Bernie Moreno, have called on him to leave the race. At the end of the day, you know I let the truth speak for itself, and the truth is right there, and I will never, ever, ever let my baby girl see her dad walk away as a quitter, Miller told CNN's Jake Tapper earlier this month. I will continue to finish this, and if I have to run all the way to the end and I'm not successful, Jake, then that's a decision I decide to make, and I can hold my head up high, knowing that I fought for the truth. More recently, Miller's ex-wife, Emily Moreno, sued Miller over allegations that he recklessly published and disclosed to the world a nude image of their daughter after a photo of their child was included in a host of documents that Miller published as he sought to fight his ex-wife abuse allegations. Miller's attorney said he was responsible for the mistake, saying in a statement that I was the only person responsible for assembling, creating, reviewing, adding, deleting, redacting, or making any changes to the information and files that were in this folder, according to Politico. Buttigieg described the matchup between the two men as a massive character contrast and called the allegations against Miller very serious in an interview with The Hill. I think when things like this come along, they represent sometimes one more opportunity to get a hearing, but what matters most is what you have to offer when you get that hearing, the former Biden official said. I think it's to his credit that Brian's been very focused on his own message, his own story. Buttigieg, like other rumored 2028 Democratic White House hopefuls, has been weighing in races heading into the midterms. The former transportation secretary more recently endorsed a slew of Indiana state legislative candidates, but has also weighed in on other races, including House and Senate contests. Asked his moves were a foreshadowing of what was to come, in just 2 years, the former South Bend mayor replied, "Right now, it's about 2026, and so much depends on getting this right. The future will come when it comes." The story is The Hill's Morning Report. Blanche steps into post-confirmation spotlight. In today's issue, Todd Blanche signals DOJ vision. Trump calls to roll back South Korea drills. CENTCOM commander defends Lincoln conditions. Kushner meeting with Netanyahu. Attorney General Todd Blanche is taking on national attention as he signals the direction that the Department of Justice, or DOJ, will take under his leadership. Blanche, whose nomination was narrowly confirmed by the Senate just over a week ago in a 50-49 vote, defended his vision for the DOJ in two Sunday morning news show appearances, notably refusing to commit to act independently of President Trump. "There's a big difference between saying we will always do our job and investigate any case and act independently of the White House. No, I'm not going to pledge that, and no attorney general should ever pledge that," Blanche said on NBC News' Meet the Press. The DOJ, despite being a part of the executive branch, has long been viewed as independent of the White House, allowing the department to make decisions without influence from the president. But Trump has openly pushed for a different relationship during his second term, often calling on the DOJ to investigate and prosecute his political rivals. Blanche said he would, of course, take Trump's view into consideration before acting and hoping every attorney general in history would not answer the question differently. He said the president has not and will not ask him to prosecute specific individuals. Trump had previously urged Blanche's predecessor, former Attorney General Pam Bondi, to move more quickly in prosecuting some of his adversaries. A few key events of Blanche's tenure have raised questions about how he would lead DOJ. Given his closeness to the president, Blanche previously worked as a personal attorney for Trump, starting with the hush money case involving Stormy Daniels between Trump's first and second terms as president. Blanche had been leading the department in an acting capacity before his confirmation this month as attorney general. While doing so, Blanche has overseen the prosecution of former FBI Director James Comey over an alleged threat to Trump, which Comey denies. Blanche also approved the creation of an anti-weaponization fund for alleged victims of political persecutions following a settlement between Trump and the IRS over the leaking of the president's tax returns during his first term. Blanche reiterated Sunday that the $1.8 billion fund is dead and never got off the ground in the first place, noting he had rescinded his May order creating it. The fund became a central focus in Blanche's confirmation battle as Republican Senators Tom Tillis of North Carolina and John Cornyn of Texas insisted that they receive assurances in writing that the fund was not going forward in exchange for their support for his confirmation. "No, the fund is dead," or whatever word you want to use, Blanche told Fox News Sunday host Shannon Bream. "It never started, so it's not as if the fund is coming back." Democrats argue loopholes remain that could allow the fund to be resurrected. Blanche stirred controversy last week with a DOJ memo arguing the president can assert executive privilege and not just in communications with the White House staff, but also private advisors outside of the government. That interpretation would seek to shield more individuals from congressional investigations, which are likely to ramp up if Democrats win back control of one or both chambers of Congress this fall. Blanche defended the opinion, saying it was just clarifying an already existing one from the DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel. "We have to let a president feel like he can have frank conversations with individuals and get honest feedback about running this country without the risk of it being used by him and others, like what you just heard, in a way that's inappropriate, he said. Blanche also made an unusual appearance for an attorney general Friday when he appeared alongside Trump at a Friday event in New York touting a reduction in violent crime, a break with norms in which law enforcement officials keep their distance from political events. Trump and Blanche both praised Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman, Republican, as he's running for governor of New York. Three things to know. The U.S. Navy is considering a major revamp of the design of its new class of aircraft carriers to better suit Trump's desires. The Hill's Philip T. Motija reports, confirming reporting from the Washington Post. The review is due in several weeks, according to a former senior U.S. official familiar with the matter. The water level at the U.S.'s second-largest reservoir, Lake Powell, has reached a record low, coming just more than a week after the level at the largest reservoir, Lake Mead, also fell to a new low. Overuse of the water, along with rising temperatures, have contributed to the depletion. Opening arguments are expected to begin today in the trial of Dwayne Davis, who is accused of orchestrating the killing of rapper Tupac Shakur. In 1996, Davis is the only person to have faced criminal charges related to Shakur's killing. Leading the day, scaling back, Trump announced Sunday that he directed Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to substantially reduce joint military exercises with South Korea, citing his very good relationship with North Korean authoritarian leader Kim Jong-un. These exercises are not only costly, with much of the cost paid for by the United States of America as usual, but send a signal that is totally inappropriate and hostile to a country that, as long as Donald J. Trump has been president, has been unthreatening and respectful, Trump wrote in a post on Truth Social. The president said it is too late to cancel the exercises, but he told Hegseth to scale them back. Trump also hinted at the U.S.-Southern Korean relationship as the U.S. continues its war with Iran. While somewhat unrelated, I recently asked the president of South Korea if they would like to join us in the denuclearization of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they said no thanks, Trump said. The joint exercises are annual large-scale defensive drills that take place in the spring and summer to strengthen the alliance between the U.S. and South Korea and improve readiness to respond to regional threats, the Hill's Mallory Wilson notes. Trump and Kim have had an up-and-down relationship throughout Trump's first and second terms, despite ridiculing him frequently. Trump met with Kim on three occasions in 2018 and 2019, marking the first-ever meetings between the leaders of the U.S. and North Korea. Trump previously commented on the 2018 summit with Kim in Singapore that he wanted to suspend the military exercises. He posted a photo of himself with Kim on Saturday on Truth Social. Despite the unfriendly look on this particular picture, there are many where we're smiling. Kim Jong-un and I get along great, he said. North Korea fired a ballistic missile Wednesday toward the sea off the Korean Peninsula's east coast in a show of force and protest against the planned joint exercises, which the North has for years denounced. Pushing back, the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, head Admiral Brad Cooper challenged concerns that have been raised about the conditions of service members on board the USS Abraham Lincoln as it is returning home from deployment. Cooper said in a statement Sunday that his visit the day before to the aircraft carrier was awe-inspiring and that Americans would beam with pride over the service members' work. He said of the Navy's 11 active nuclear aircraft carriers, the Lincoln currently has among the lowest number of cases related to mental health. This doesn't mean that all is perfect. Find any of the nearly 4 million Navy veterans in America today, and they will likely tell you that service at sea for long periods isn't for everyone, Cooper said. His comments come as reports have indicated that the crew have had to deal with increasingly worsening conditions during their 265-day of deployment amid the Iran war. That's included moldy showers and rotten food, and some sailors haven't even attempted to jump off the Lincoln into the sea. Acting Navy Secretary Hung Cao announced Friday that the carrier was returning home, months after its initially planned return in May, but congressional Democrats have launched inquiries into the physical and mental states of the service members. Making the rounds, the president's son-in-law Jared Kushner is meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu today, a day after a rare conference with the leader of the militant group Hamas in Egypt. The meetings come as the Trump administration tries to hold together its deal for Hamas to disarm as part of the broader plan for the group to gradually transfer power to a committee to oversee civilian and security functions in the Gaza Strip. The deal calls for the removal of Israeli forces from Gaza as the disarmament process takes place. Netanyahu has rejected the proposal, insisting that Hamas disarm before Israel withdraws. Two Hamas officials and another official briefed on the meeting told the New York Times that Kushner met with Hamas leaders in Egypt, including Khalil el-Haya, the chair of Hamas's political bureau. Kushner and Hamas didn't immediately share details about the meeting. Kushner is now expected to huddle in Israel with Netanyahu to discuss the Gaza situation, the Times reported. The Hill exclusive, former Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is endorsing Brian Poindexter in his congressional race against the controversial Representative Max Miller, Republican of Ohio. Buttigieg told The Hill's Caroline Vakel in an exclusive that Poindexter, a Brook Park City Council member, understands the difficulties that working families are facing because he's a card-carrying union iron worker. He's an example of somebody who walks the walk, he said. Poindexter is challenging the two-term incumbent Miller in Ohio's 7th Congressional District, based south of Cleveland and west of Akron. The district leans conservative as Trump carried it by 11 points in the 2024 election, but Miller has refused calls to drop out as he faces allegations of domestic abuse from his ex-wife that has contributed to Democratic hopes of possibly being able to flip the district in November. In the where and when, the president will receive an intelligence briefing at 11 a.m. He will greet lifeguard Ryder Williams at 1 p.m. The House will convene at 9 a.m. for a pro forma session. The Senate will meet at 1:30 p.m. for a pro forma session. And finally, the famed former MLB pitcher Tommy John, the namesake of a surgery he became the first to successfully return from, died over the weekend at age 83. John's death comes about a week after he released a statement to say goodbye and thank his fans and teammates who supported him. He had been in hospice. John had been pitching in the MLB for more than a decade when he suffered a UCL injury. He received what became known as Tommy John surgery, and despite missing the entire 1975 season, was able to return for 14 more years on the mound. While the surgery at one point was considered the end of a player's career, John was the first of many who were able to return after the procedure. Known as the Bionic Man, John was honored Sunday by various teams and others throughout baseball.